loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm Brian Becker. In our first hour, we have our weekly segment called The Week in Review. We'll talk about the week in politics, policy, and international affairs. We'll talk about the government shutdown and its impact on working people. We're going to talk about the teacher strike in Los Angeles, the acquittal of Chicago police officers, and the prospects for a U.S. withdrawal from Syria and more.
But before we get to those stories, we'll go over today's headlines, including five that we'll cover in depth in the second hour. First, the White House announced today that the second summit between Donald Trump and North Korean leader Kim Jong-un will take place in late February at a yet-to-be-determined location. This dramatic announcement comes after North Korean lead negotiator Kim Yong-chol visited Washington to meet with Trump and Secretary of State Mike Pompeo. Next, a new story published by BuzzFeed is being called a bombshell that will lead to Donald Trump either resigning or being impeached. The story, however, is based on anonymous sources. It asserts that Donald Trump directed his then-personal lawyer, Michael Cohen, to lie to Congress about the nature and timing of negotiations between the Trump Organization and individuals in Moscow who are trying to broker a deal to set up a Trump Tower in that city. We'll take a look at the story and its authors. Then, four activists with the humanitarian organization No More Deaths are on trial in Tucson, Arizona, facing charges from an arrest in 2017 related to their efforts to place life-saving supplies like water in a stretch of desert near the U.S.-Mexico border to prevent migrants from dying of thirst and starvation. The outcome of the case will have wide-reaching implications for humanitarians and immigrant rights activists. And then, as Jeremy Corbyn comes closer and closer to becoming the Prime Minister of the UK, attacks against him are ramping up. One line of attack has been the allegation that Corbyn, a longtime supporter of Palestinian rights and opponent of intervention in the Middle East, is anti-Semitic. Now, a new report shows that bot accounts on social media are being used to provide false evidence for these claims. And finally, we'll take a look at the worst, most misleading, funniest, and just plain wrong headlines of the past week. And in other headlines, the partial government shutdown is finishing up its fourth week today. Last Friday, federal workers on furlough and those forced to work without pay missed their first paycheck. If the government is still closed next Friday, they'll miss a second one. Yesterday, a Sudanese man hid unarmed protesters in his house from police and was subsequently killed by security forces. This morning, Sudanese police fired into the crowd of about 2,000 mourners that formed at that slain man's house. Protesters have been in the streets for weeks protesting economic measures that have raised the price of essential goods, causing major hardship for poor and working people in the country. Senator Bob Casey of Pennsylvania announced today that he would not be running for president in 2020. Casey, a Democrat whose state was surprisingly won by Donald Trump in 2016, had earlier hinted at the possibility of running. Twitter admitted yesterday that Android users' private tweets had been unprotected due to a glitch in the app disabling the Protect Your Tweets setting. The tweets were unprotected for over 4 years, since November 2014. Those are today's headlines. You're listening to Loud and Clear.
Loud and Clear.
Now we turn to our Friday segment called The Week in Review. We talk about the week in politics, policy, and international affairs. We're joined in studio by Jacqueline Lookman. She is the editor-in-chief of Lookman Nation. You can check out their live stream every week on Facebook and YouTube. And we're joined in studio by Sputnik news analyst and producer Walter Smolarek. Jackie, Walter, welcome back.
Glad to be here.
Happy to be here.
Again, a lot of big stories in the news, and some of them might turn out to be not true. We're going to talk about some of them that may or may not be true as this show goes on today. But there's one story that is true, but we didn't know about it before. We knew there was a problem, but we didn't know the size of the problem. And that is the decision by the U.S. government under this administration to forcibly, consciously, deliberately separate kids, including the youngest children, from their parents at the border. And it went on not only when Jeff Sessions announced the zero tolerance policy, it went on well before it. This is a new and big story, Jackie.
We knew it was bad. We did not know the scope of how horrible this policy really was. And we still don't know. We still don't know how many children were separated from their families at the border. This story, as it was reported in the New York Times, point to not just this policy of family separation that Trump used as punishment or as a deterrent, as both punishment and a deterrent for people trying to, quote unquote, cross the southern border illegally. But it also points to a separate policy that was put in place by this administration that made it harder for families of the children to have to get the children placed into their custody. So when the Department of Homeland Security says we're following the law, saying that we're separating children from people who are in the custody of questionable adults or their parents are wanted for crimes, or if that's true, then why won't this administration let the relatives of those children take them in instead of putting them in a detention center, or I don't know if it's worse, but it's all horrendous, or putting them in foster care?
Yeah. And some of those family members, Walter, when the government was compelled because of a court order to stop this policy, when some of the relatives tried to show up and bring the kids back into some remnant of a family, the people who came were then fingerprinted, and some of them were then arrested for not having their papers in order. And as a consequence, people got scared. I mean, whether your papers are in order or not, if you're from Latin America and you're an immigrant, you don't know what's going to happen under these circumstances. So people just stopped showing up to get the children back. Again, that was deliberate.
Yeah, yeah. And I think this is the piece of U.S. immigration policy that is new under the Trump administration. I mean, we all know that, you know, Barack Obama deported record, huge, enormous numbers of people, more than the Trump administration, in fact. But what I think we've seen in the past couple of years is that U.S. immigration policy has become more terroristic, right? It's more about sowing fear and terror in communities and doing it so on the basis of more or less explicit racism. So, you know, like the family separation policy, which it's unclear, you know, the extent to which it existed, you know, not to say that that did not exist prior to Donald Trump coming into office, but it was clearly ramped up. It became much more of a public issue. And it has this clearly punitive, terroristic motive to it that would just, you know, sort of scare people back into the shadows, more or less. And also just, I mean, think about how traumatizing this is for the children who for months and months and months have been separated from their parents, from any family members. I mean, like the lasting psychological harm that does to kids. I mean, it'll stay with people for the rest of their lives.
Yeah, you have 3-year-olds, 2-year-olds, 5-year-olds, 6-year-olds. So what? Even if you're 9 or 10, can you imagine you're with your family, you've been with your family, you've been with your mom or dad or one or both of them for your entire life, you come, you're fleeing violence, you're fleeing some major problem so as to seek asylum, which is everyone's legal right to make an asylum claim. And you're suddenly ripped apart from your parents and you're put in detention, you're put in cages, and you might not see them for weeks, for months. And now we know it's been many, many months longer than that. I want to read a couple of sentences from this article. The Trump administration most likely separated thousands more children from their parents at the southern border than was previously believed. The federal government has reported that nearly 3,000 children were forcibly separated from their parents under last year's, quote, zero tolerance, close quote, immigration policy, under which nearly all adults entering the country illegally were prosecuted and any child accompanying them was put into a shelter or foster care. But even before the administration officially unveiled the zero tolerance policy in the spring of 2018, staff of the United States Department of Health and Human Services, that should be renamed, the agency that oversees the care of children in federal custody, had noted, quote, a sharp increase, close quote, in the number of children separated from their a parent or guardian, according to the report from the agency's Office of Inspector General. The total number of children separated from a parent or guardian by immigration authorities is, quote, unknown, close quote, because of the lack of a coordinated formal tracking system between the Office of Refugee Resettlement and the Department of Homeland Security. Now, again, this is a cruel immigration system. United States has the Statue of Liberty in New York Harbor. Give us your tired, your huddled masses yearning to breathe free. The whole idea that America was built on immigration, of course, it was also built on the kidnapping of millions, literally millions of African people who came not as immigrants, but as enslaved people, or the conquering of the lands and people who were the original inhabitants of North America. That would be indigenous people. That's who America is. But now we have a system whereby hundreds of thousands of people are being locked up and deported. That was during the Obama era when he was called deporter in chief. And he said he was doing that to show the conservatives, the right wing, the Republicans, that he was serious about border security in order to then go forward for a comprehensive immigration deal, which, of course, turned out to be a fantasy. And then we take it one step further. The Trump administration, which is not seeking or not pretending to seek comprehensive immigration reform, just wants to drive immigrants, especially brown or black people, out of America and tell them, if you're black and brown, don't you dare try to come to America, because guess what? We're gonna grab your kids.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a cruel, barbaric system.
But it is the system, like you said, that this country actually was built on. I mean, we talked, I think, last week about the over 600,000 visa overstays. Most of the people who are, quote unquote, undocumented in this country are actually undocumented from visa overstays. People who actually come in to this country through an airport with a visa, and then they just decide not to go home. Nobody's taking their children. No one's taking their children away, because most of those people are from European countries. And remember, this is a country that has continually ignored its history of destroying the families of marginalized, enslaved, Native, Asian, Hispanic people. We're talking about separating babies from enslaved mothers and selling them as property, separating Native children from their families to, what was the phrase, save the child and kill the Indian, or something like that, and sending children, Native children, to Christian assimilation schools, basically re-education camps for Native children. And I look at it, the same things were done with Asian children during the Chinese Exclusion Act and that period of time where Chinese people were discriminated against. I look at these children who are being put into foster care. It's horrible enough that the children are put into detention camps with, I mean, uncaring people who don't even see them as human. But then you have this other group of children who are put into foster care, and they're, to me, they're the same. They will suffer the same kind of fate, that they'll be fed into the same kind of re-education indoctrination system, into this Christo-fascist ideology that really is driving this racial hatred that's targeting these people, and that has always targeted people of color and marginalized them in this country.
Let's go on to another story. Three Chicago police officers were acquitted, Walter, acquitted of covering up the murder of Laquan McDonald, young black teenager, 16 years old, shot 16 times, a completely cold-blooded murder. We have Jason Van Dyke, the police officer who fired 16 bullets into the body of Laquan McDonald. He's been found guilty, which is very, very rare that a police officer is ever held to account. But these other three police officers were charged with covering up. And obviously, there had to be a cover-up for the killing of Laquan McDonald. I mean, the government itself, Rahm Emanuel, the mayor, covered it up because he didn't release the video for a year. And when it finally was released and it showed the cold-blooded, unspeakable character of this crime by the police against this young man, the people in Chicago went into the streets. And it's only because they went into the streets and they stayed in the streets that there was even a trial. There was even like a charge against a police officer, and then a trial, and then a conviction. But again, it's what's called the code of silence, Walter. I mean, yes, it exists. The fact that NPR had this report the other day that said, is there a code of silence? Hello. Of course, everyone who knows anything about the police in America knows this exists.
On those very rare occasions, which are important to celebrate when the People's Movement wins justice for victims of racist police violence, you know, the politicians, the apologists for the police, they'll always go in front of the cameras and say, well, you know, this person was one bad apple on an otherwise upstanding police force that's, you know, doing its best every day to keep people safe. But, you know, what these cover-ups, what these conspiracies show is that that's not true. It's actually the entire police force that's involved in these types of things, even if, you know, not everybody is involved in these sort of like unspeakable acts of violence and murder. Everybody is involved in keeping those things covered up. And, you know, the few police officers who do speak out about these things are very frequently driven off of the force, or in fact, basically in all cases, driven off of the force. So, yeah, I mean, it's clearly an issue of the role that the police play in these communities, the role of the police in containing oppressed communities. And you know, I think it's a shame that these police officers were acquitted for what was such a clear and obvious and political cover-up.
The three police officers, David March, Joseph Walsh, and Thomas Gaffney, it's these three. Now, what did they do? Here you have Van Dyke. He empties his gun into the body of Laquan McDonald. He's shot 16 times, including when he's already shot and lying motionless on the ground. He keeps pumping him full of bullets, right? The officers were accused of writing in official reports that Laquan had tried to stab three other officers, saying they saw him trying to get up from the ground even after a barrage of shots. Now, that's not a cover-up. That's not a cover-up.
I mean, it's absolutely a cover-up, especially when we did finally see the video, when it was finally released, and we saw how Laquan McDonald was murdered. There was no way anyone looking at that scene from any vantage point could have believed that he was trying to get up after he was shot, after he was down, rather, after, and then he had continued to be shot. But this is what these three officers said, but this is why their attorney requested
a bench trial. Just a judge,
of a
no jury.
Trial. Yep. Because the judge, Judge Dominica Stevenson, delivered her opinion for over an hour. And what she did was basically to recriminalize Laquan McDonald in defense of these three officers. She said it was clear that McDonald was disobeying orders from the police. This young man has been murdered. He is dead. His family is still grieving. And they don't know what kind of justice, what level of justice they're going to get, because Van Dyke is going to be sentenced today, actually. But they can't even focus on that, because the three officers, and it wasn't just those three. It was, these are just the three that were the closest to. It was all of them. They were just the three who were indicted. They can't, his family can't even focus on the sentencing today, because they have to deal with the fact that three of these people who were involved in covering up their son's murder have been let off by this judge who, once again, re-victimize their child.
And the fact of the matter is, if there was nobody videotaping this murder by the police of Laquan McDonald shooting him 16 times, if there was no video, there would have been no charges. That's the reality. That's the way it works in America, everybody. That's the way it works. I can remember one of the first days after I moved to New York City, I was passing by Port Authority, and I saw on, I think it was 31st Street, in a little sort of alleyway, the police wailing on somebody. They had like four or five cops with batons just beating somebody over and over and over again. Like, that's the way it is. But before, there weren't smartphones and people taking videos, and that's just the way it is. And the police have a license to beat, they have a license to kill, and they use that license routinely because they know they're not going to be held to account. Now, the judge said, quote, two people with two different vantage points can witness the same event. Okay, we're looking at the videotape. You can see Laquan McDonald is walking away from the police. He doesn't want to be, maybe he's not running, he's walking away. They're next to him, they're parallel to him, they're about 15, 20 feet away. This one cop, Van Dyke, gets out, pulls his gun out, and shoots him 16 times. Again, continues to shoot him while he's motionless on the ground. You see that on the video. And the judge says, well, two people with two different vantage points can witness the same event. Well, what about the report that the police filed? I mean, yeah, that Laquan McDonald was trying to stab them. I mean, how does that play into this? This is so ludicrous. And again, I don't know what it is. Maybe the judge is afraid of the police. Maybe the judge just knows because the police, you know, they're a dangerous. They're the other biggest gang in America, right?
True.
And they have the license to carry arms. They have the license, the legal license to use violence. They're the only part of America that actually, you know, has the official license to use violence. Maybe the judge is afraid. Maybe everybody's intimidated. I know there is a lot of intimidation. Or maybe the courts and the judges just know the deal, and because of the corrupt character of the system, they go along to get along, or maybe they don't care. It could be one of those things, but it's not justice.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. It's all of those things together. I think the fundamental thing is the role of the police. I mean, just let's take like a big look at what this society is. There's a tiny handful of people who have basically everything and who run basically everything. I mean, and I'm not just talking about people who, you know, like live in the suburbs. I mean, like people who have, you know, 8 mansions and own banks. And, you know, there's unbelievable inequality in this society. And it's also a society that has as its basis, because there is vast wealth, even though it's distributed unequally, that has at its very core the racist exploitation of Black people, the genocide of Indigenous people, you know, ruthless exploitation of other people of color. And so when you have this mix, right, of extreme racism and unbelievable inequality, the only way that you can possibly keep that arrangement together is through overwhelming force. And that's the job of the police. Now, within that system, right, the police create organizations to advocate especially aggressively for their right to carry out acts of brutality. And, you know, that's called the Fraternal Order of Police. The Fraternal Order of Police is not a union. Cops are not workers. The FOP is like a gang, right? And a far-right political organization. And so, sure, I mean, I think that does come into play in court cases like this and in political cases. Like, after Eric Garner was murdered by the New York Police Department a few years ago, there was sort of like a semi-coup against Mayor de Blasio by the New York Police Department. I mean, he was, you know, addressing like hundreds of officers, and they all turned their back on him because he wasn't. And it's not like he was like a great friend of the movement against police brutality. He was just like insufficiently like all in supporting the cops.
Well, it wasn't a coup against de Blasio, although I know what you mean, because de Blasio turned around and basically he understood the deal. He knew the game. He embraced the police. He turned his back on the things that he said he was for while he was campaigning. Let's turn to another story. A big story this week, of course, is the teachers in Los Angeles are out. They're standing strong. They have the support of students. They have the support of parents. It's an amazing, important step forward for the labor movement. Jackie, what I think we're witnessing after the strikes, the teacher strikes in West Virginia, in Oklahoma, in Arizona, in other places, and now those were red states, Republican states. This is Los Angeles, and this is California, clearly not red, blue, Democrat. But the teachers are out. You know, it's the changing face of labor. It's women predominantly, a lot of people of color, maybe the majority. The new face of labor, the new face of labor resistance, really something.
Yeah. And it's interesting, this particular strike in L.A., because it originated kind of in the largest, I think it's the second largest school district in the country, the Los Angeles Unified School District. And the district is very distinct because 73% of the students are Latino. Another 15% or so are other ethnic groups. So a significant percentage of these teachers are Latino. And they are actually some of them are the descendants of the earlier late 60s, early 70s movement of Mexican people for rights for Mexicans in L.A. So it's like this continuation of not just a labor movement, but of a civil rights movement, that they're continuing to see the lack of equal access, equal funding, and equal rights for Latino students in their classrooms. The classes are overcrowded. There are not enough resources, social resources, just plain old school, you know, classroom resources. And of course, teacher pay is abysmal. So the teachers are out here advocating for their students. And because this student population is so besieged and pretty much alone, the only people who care about them are their parents and the teachers who come from these neighborhoods, who came up in these schools, who came up through that struggle for Latino rights, they are supportive of their teachers. And it's only growing. It is only growing. And it's a really, really great thing to see.
Walter, we interviewed the vice president of the union out there in Los Angeles. She's been a school teacher herself for 23 years. I asked her, this was 2 days ago, I asked her, how's morale? How is it? Because it's hard to be on strike. You're worried, you're not getting paid. You know, if some people start to go back and cross the picket line, others might get demoralized. I mean, there's a lot to a strike. It's a complicated issue. So morale is all important. And she said, and I said, between 0 and 10, 10 being the highest, how's morale? She said, it's a 10. I don't doubt that, because I think the teachers also feel not only their own strength, but they feel that they're somehow leading a movement for justice that affects people all over the country. You kind of sense it in the media even.
Yeah, and also in the turnout for the enormous demonstrations that they've been having in Los Angeles. So, I mean, you know, when workers are on strike, it's not like they have a vacation. I mean, they're working very, very hard at the struggle. And so, you know, early morning picket lines are extremely well attended, but the most visually impressive have been these sort of citywide rallies that are usually held a little bit later in the day. And I mean, you know, you can go online and find the aerial footage of it. It's just tens of thousands of people, both members of UTLA, United Teachers of Los Angeles, that's the union on strike, but also, you know, community supporters, you know, people who are honking while they go past the picket line. I mean, when we were interviewing, you know, the vice president that you had just mentioned, you know, we heard constantly in the background, you know, honking and cheering, and people were like, really, people were into it because they know that the teachers are fighting, like Jackie said, for not just themselves, but actually for, you know, the well-being of their students and their communities. And yeah, absolutely, it's part of a bigger struggle, both in terms of just education, right? Because there's been a wave of these teachers' strikes and demonstrations and marches and rallies for about a year now. And also, I think just in general, the fight against the privatization of public goods, because that's what this really comes down to. The superintendent of the LA school district, he has zero experience whatsoever in education. What he is a hedge fund manager.
Perfect.
Yeah, he's a finance capitalist, and he is clearly being brought in there to privatize little by little the school system so they can go to charter operators and ultimately private operators who can turn a profit.
Yeah, we have about 45 seconds left, Walter, so I'm going to ask you a quick follow-up question. You know, factories have been running away when they're faced with militant labor struggles, union organizing drives. The schools can't run away. They can't go to China. They can't go to Latin America. They're here. It kind of makes sense that this would be the place where labor starts to revive. 30 seconds left.
Yeah, it absolutely makes sense. And it's, you know, it's on the front lines of, right, like I was saying, the privatization struggle. It's an obvious place where you can build alliances with other progressive forces in society, in the neighborhoods, among parents, among students, too. You know, young people are on these picket lines as well, and in very large numbers supporting their teachers because they know that they're standing up for their future against people who want to, you know, do all sorts of injustices to them, not just in their schools.
We're going to leave it there for now, but we're coming back after a short break to continue our segment called The Week in Review, where we look at the big issues in politics, policy, and international affairs. We will be joined after the break once again with Jacqueline Lookman. She is the editor-in-chief of Lookman Nation. You can check out their live stream every week on Facebook and YouTube, and we're joined in studio by Sputnik News analyst and producer Walter Smolarek. Stay tuned.
Loud and clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker. We're talking about the big issues of the week in this segment that happens every Friday called The Week in Review. We talk about the week in politics, policy, and international affairs. We're joined in studio by Jacqueline Lookman, editor-in-chief of Lookman Nation. You can check out their live stream every week on Facebook and YouTube. And we're joined in studio by Sputnik News analyst and producer Walter Smolarek. Jackie, let's talk about what happened in Syria this week. Again, you know, thousands of Syrians have been dying, tens of thousands, actually hundreds of thousands. It's not very big news, but this week, something that was big news was the death of four American personnel. Two were U.S. Soldiers. One was a DIA agent, defense intelligence agents. Another was a private contractor. They were killed by a suicide bomber, and immediately by the way, it wasn't just the four Americans. 19 Syrians also died, and many, many more were wounded. But in American media, the death of these four Americans was taken to make the argument that Donald Trump is committing a gross, fundamental foreign policy error by saying that U.S. troops in Syria should leave. That's the commentary. Now, it's really weird when you look at people on TV, in studios, people who are comfortable, people who are not going to get blown up, saying, oh, this is terrible. After the explosion that took the lives of these Americans, we should stay in Syria. It might occur to a lot of American soldiers and certainly their families that leaving Syria might be better than staying in Syria if, in fact, the American soldiers are not a decisive factor in the military outcome, because there's only 2,000 of them, but they certainly can be the targets.
It's interesting. It's odd. Interesting isn't even the right word. It's perplexing how no one in the corporate media is making the connection that, you know, if we weren't there, this would have never happened. But that's, of course, they can't say that. We can say that, but they can't say that. So now when you listen to media, when you listen to the corporate media on the radio, when you watch it on television, now they're making the argument that basically, see, this is why Trump's decision to withdraw from Syria was such a disaster. And I actually heard that on, I don't know what radio show it was, but I think it was some conservative talk radio show. And they were actually saying, you know, some Pentagon official, some unnamed Pentagon official who was saying, you know, listen, this is why we have to keep the fight in Syria. So, yes, this entire horrendous event that I'm glad you brought up, that it didn't just take the lives of four Americans. There were 20 Syrians whose lives were either taken or affected by this. This is now the reasoning for why I think we're not only going to stay in Syria, but now more we're going to increase troop strength in Syria. I think that's going to be the outcome of this. But that was always what the Pentagon wanted.
There's two elements of this that I want to talk about a little bit more, Walter, and sort of probe into. The argument that's being made against Trump is that Trump is doing exactly what Barack Obama did by announcing in advance that he was going to pull U.S. troops out of Iraq at the end of 2011. That was a campaign promise that he made during the 2008 election, that he would withdraw U.S. troops. He went forward with the promise, and then a couple of years later, ISIS took the city of Mosul, which is the second or third biggest city in Iraq. ISIS sort of came out of nowhere and created a caliphate in both Syria and Iraq and became a major force and almost appeared to be able to take Baghdad, or at least march on Baghdad. And then the U.S. sent troops back to Iraq, and that was Barack Obama again, redeploying troops. And so the foreign policy critics are saying, learn the lesson of Iraq, because if the U.S. leaves Syria, it will mean ISIS comes back. But this is, one, not analogous. And two, before the U.S. went into Iraq or into Syria, there was no ISIS. Before the U.S. went into Iraq, there was certainly no ISIS, right? The Saddam Hussein government was not tolerating an ISIS-type group. Before the United States started supporting the civil war, so-called, the armed terrorist organizations in Syria, which the U.S. started to do after 2011, before then, there was no ISIS. So you can make the argument the U.S. is actually part of the problem and, as such, not part of the solution. But then the other part of it is that this is not analogous to Iraq at all, because ISIS has been in the main defeated, but not by the United States, not by the United States hardly at all.
Yeah, both of those points are extremely important. And at every step of the way, when you look at the history of the expansion of ISIS, you can draw a direct link to the United States foreign policy and geopolitical decisions in the Middle East. So like you were saying, the existence of what was then called the Islamic State in Iraq, the Al-Qaeda affiliate of Iraq, was, a direct consequence of the U.S. invasion that destroyed the Iraqi government as such and imposed an explicitly sectarian system on the country.
And explain sectarian for our audience.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, Iraq is a multi-ethnic, multi-religious society. There are Kurdish Muslims in the north. There are Shiite Arab Muslims, there are Sunni Arab Muslims, there are, you know, a number of other smaller ethnicities as well. And, you know, under the Ba'ath government, it was a secular government, whatever else you want to say about it, it was a secular government. And so what existed after the U.S. invasion, what was set up under what was effectively the dictatorship of L. Paul Bremer and the Coalition Provisional Authority, was a system where the prime minister of Iraq would always be a Shiite Arab, the speaker of the parliament would always be a Sunni Arab, and the president of the country would always be a Kurd. So in other words, that the political positions in the country were divvied up on a sectarian basis, creating the basis for the modern Iraqi politics. There was another policy called de-Ba'athification, which means that, you know, if you are a member of the old ruling party, the Ba'ath Party, if you had an association with the old ruling party, the Ba'ath Party, you are effectively blacklisted from society. And that included, and especially was applied to, the security services. So there was effectively the disbanding of the Iraqi army following the invasion. And so people, you know, had nowhere to go. They were basically blacklisted. They couldn't get a job. But because it was chaos, they could actually sometimes bring their weapons with them. So then you have this, you know, sectarian ideology that's sort of undergirded by the actual imposed political system. You have this policy of de-Ba'athification. And so a civil war broke out. And the Lancet Medical Journal, a highly respected medical journal, found that there is over 1 million excess deaths, you know, people who wouldn't have otherwise died as a consequence of the invasion and the subsequent civil war. That's where ISIS came from. It moved across the border into Syria. Instead of Islamic State of Iraq, it became Islamic State of Iraq and Syria once the, you know, U.S. started sponsoring the civil war there. And then there's one other point, I think, in the growth of ISIS, is that the reason why ISIS was able to take over, you know, a third or half of Iraq, was able to take the city of Mosul, which was the pretext for the beginning of the U.S. bombing, was because the Iraqi army collapsed. You know, because the U.S. destroyed the old Iraqi army, they had to create this new one. They spent many, many billions of dollars, I think $25 billion creating it. And it was riddled with corruption. There was this phenomenon called ghost soldiers. So, you know, I think there were like 50,000 soldiers in Iraq who are like on the books, but they're actually fictitious.
Their commanders were collecting the pay.
Wow. Yeah. So it's this neo-colonial puppet army that was completely incapable of fighting.
Yeah. Unlike the Ba'athist army. So when ISIS, about 2,000 or 3,000 ISIS fighters made the move on Mosul, the Iraqi army in Mosul was 30,000, but they did not fight. They fled. That's how ISIS captured Mosul in the north. But let's think about it again. I want to break it down for Americans, especially, who won't really understand what setting up a sectarian system is. Think about it this way, everybody. Think about the United States has like 330 million people, right? Let's say a power came in that took over the United States that had 10 times as many people, because the United States, Iraq only had 28 million people when the U.S. invaded. It was 10 times plus smaller. So it's a minor power compared to the United States. Let's say a foreign power that was 10 times as big as the United States came in and decided to organize a new government so that the president would always be a white man. Well, until Barack Obama, it always was. So that wouldn't be a big sharp.
Sounds familiar.
Let's say they organized it so that everything was organized. If you're a white, you got this position, you got these kind of positions, you got this amount of money. If you're black, if you're Latino, if you're Asian, like the entire country was funded on purely ethnic, racial basis, a sectarian basis. And then you funded people to form militias. And then when they started to fight you, you paid them more money so that they wouldn't fight you. They could fight other militias that you're also funding. That's what the United States did to Iraq. I went to Iraq starting in 1990. People were not describing themselves as Sunni or Shiite. They did describe themselves as Kurds, because Kurds have a separate language, a separate part of the country, the northern part of the country, although 1 million Kurds also by then lived in Baghdad, a city of 6 million. But people didn't think of themselves as Sunni or Shiite. They thought of themselves as Iraqis. America developed the Sunni-Shiite system of rule for the same reason that the Brits in India developed the Muslim-Hindu form of rule, which ultimately led to the creation of Pakistan separate from India. In other words, colonial divide and conquer tactics. Then within those tactics, some of the people who are being organized on a purely sectarian ethnic basis become super nationalists like ISIS, like super Islamicists, representing a part of the population that felt that they were getting the raw deal. That was the part of the population that was Sunni. That's actually what happened. America, not because it necessarily, there's a debate about this, wanted to create ISIS, but America did create ISIS. It was at least minimally the unintended consequences of this reactionary, I would say racist, divide and conquer tactic.
I mean, listening to you, Brian, and you, Walter, explain how ISIS came to be is so incredibly critical. But see, I like foreign policy, so it's interesting to me. But I also understand that for most Americans, I mean, a headline on a corporate news station that's breaking news of a suicide bomb in, you know, going off at a cafe is all most people need to continue to support the war machine. And this is why we have a corporate structure in this country that does not educate Americans on these issues, because if we did, we would never have gone to Iraq. We would never have been in Syria, because we would have understood these things and we would not have allowed our government to carry them out. But instead, we have, you know, breaking news, fluff stories to whip people up into this false patriotic frenzy to continue to support this war machine.
I want to just spend another minute on this story and then move on to another one. Again, we see now the Pentagon is saying that the Americans who were killed at that cafe had become complacent. They kept going to that cafe. American government officials have gone to that cafe. I mean, it's a well-known place. But what's curious, Walter, to me, is that right after Trump announces the U.S. is going to leave Syria, withdraw American troops from Syria, in Manbij, a town that was under the control of ISIS until 2 years ago, but liberated from the control of ISIS 2 years ago. Since that time, in this entire 2 years, there hasn't been a single terrorist attack, not one. And suddenly, out of the blue, where these Americans have been frequenting all this time, there's an explosion that kills them, and that becomes the basis for all of the critics of the withdrawal to say, see, we must stay. Again, I don't want to be conspiratorial, but it is a bit curious.
Yeah, it's very suspicious. I mean, right, we can't draw any definitive conclusions from it, but all we can do is look at the timing and whose interest is it that this happened. And, you know, as is the case with wars, you know, oftentimes the truth comes out, but not for many years. And it'll be extremely important when the truth does come out to make that known to everybody, because, you know, these wars over and over and over again are based on, you know, this enforced amnesia, you know, like Jackie was talking about, through the corporate media, also through the education system. I mean, so many, I would say basically all U.S. wars, maybe with a couple exceptions, have been based on fundamentally false pretenses. And so, you know, we always have to be questioning these types of things.
Yeah, Gore Vidal, the author, called the USA the United States of Amnesia. He's not wrong there, but it's an enforced amnesia. It's not because the people can't think and can't remember. The media doesn't want them to remember, because the memories form strong lessons and strong critiques of the existing powers that be. I want to go on to another story. I think this is a really important story, a very troubling story, and a story that I think has ramifications for everybody, especially people in the alternative media, and that's the arrest of Marzieh Hashemi, African-American woman born in the United States. Her family's from here. She lives in St. Louis. She comes back from Iran, where she's a very popular anchor on a TV news program called The Debate. She was coming back to St. Louis while here because she's a working person. Even while visiting family, she was going to make a documentary about the Black Lives Matter movement in St. Louis. And of course, St. Louis is close to Ferguson, where Mike Brown was killed, where the Black Lives Movement really exploded in response to that police killing. She gets off a plane, boom, she's arrested. Her family doesn't know where she is. Nobody knows where she is. The media reports on Monday, where we covered this story, was the FBI had filed unspecified charges against her. Well, guess what? They haven't filed any charges against her. They're now saying she's a material witness, which is the FBI's way of saying, we don't have to acknowledge that you have any rights, like the right not to be searched and seized by the U.S. government. And if you're arrested, of course, you have to have an arraignment, and you can plead not guilty, and you can call a lawyer, and You know, you have all of these rights, minimal rights, but rights nonetheless. But if you're a material witness, they can just hold you and hold you and hold you. And that's what's happened to her.
Unfortunately, the corporate media, again, is not reporting this as an issue of an American citizen whose rights are being violated by the American government. The government that is speaking out the most fervently on behalf of this woman is the Iranian government. And of course, because it's Iran, people in this country are saying, well, you know, of course, she's an agent of Iran. But Brian, you brought up some other really great points about why she also could be a target of the FBI. And that's her focus on Black Lives Matter. I mean, Black dissent, Black liberation movements in this country, the liberation movements of marginalized people have always been targets of the FBI. And just because she's a journalist and she wanted to do a documentary on Black Lives Matter, people need to understand that that's not, journalism is not like a benign thing in this country. Journalism is supposed to represent the delivery of truth and information to educate people, not just in this country, but around the world. And the worst thing that could happen for the powers that be in this country is for all of the marginalized people around the world to rally behind a movement like Black Lives Matter. The same way they didn't want the world rallying behind the Black Panther Party, the American Indian movement, you know, all of the movements of marginalized people. So there are lots of reasons this woman is being held against her will with no charges in a clear violation of her rights as a citizen and as a human being. And they're not simple. And I don't think we're going to get a forthcoming answer from the FBI. This is a really frightening situation.
Go ahead, Walter.
Yeah, I mean, you have those two things at play, right? I mean, so, you know, Marzieh Hashmi is an African-American journalist who exposes, you know, the injustices of this system, or at least doesn't turn a blind eye to it, like, you know, the 99% of the mainstream media. And there's also, I mean, this is also such an illustration of how the legal system in the United States, the court system, functions as, in certain cases, as an extension of U.S. aggressive foreign policy. You know, it's a top priority of the Trump administration to overthrow the government of Iran. And so because Marzieh Hashmi works for Press TV, and I think it's because Press TV allows her to cover the things that, you know, would be completely censored and blacked out in other, you know, other media outlets in the United States. Because of that, you know, she becomes a target for this ridiculous injustice. I mean, we don't even know what really it is. I mean, material witness could mean anything. The FBI for days wouldn't even tell the family any details at all, basically.
And I just want to add, because I don't want us to miss the clear normalization of government-sponsored Islamophobia that's being committed against this journalist. They have denied her halal foods so that the only thing she's eaten is crackers, because everything has pork in it, or she doesn't know if it's come in contact with pork products. She has been denied her hijab. As a matter of fact, it was forcibly taken off her. And we're seeing this aggression, this hatred, this open hatred toward Muslims against Ilhan Omar and against Rashida Tlaib, where politicians are openly accusing these lawmakers, these lawfully elected lawmakers, human beings and American citizens, of possibly committing an act of terrorism in Congress. I think somebody accused Ilhan Omar of she might bomb Congress. This is the kind of legalized, normalized Islamophobia that is being carried out by this administration. And I think that is something that we should not miss in what's going on here.
That's the voice of Jacqueline Lookman. She is the editor-in-chief of the Lookman Nation. We're also talking with Walter Smolarek. He is a Sputnik News analyst and a producer of this show. We talk about the week in review, meaning the big issues of the week, every Friday in this segment on Loud and Clear. Let's go on to another story, Walter. Here's from the New York Times. A global New York-based law firm has agreed to pay $4.6 million to settle a Justice Department investigation into whether its work for a Russia-aligned Ukrainian government violated lobbying laws. This has to do with the law firm Skadden, Arps, Slate, Meager, and Flom. Okay, there's another part which you could have made the front part of this story, the lead, which is this law firm and the person who's been accused of not being honest about their lobbying efforts, along with Paul Manafort, for the Ukrainian government of Viktor Yanukovych, the government that was overthrown in a U.S.-backed coup in February 2014, is none other than Craig, who was the White House general counsel for Barack Obama, a leading Democrat, in other words. So you had Tony Podesta, brother of John Podesta. John Podesta was the chairperson of Hillary Clinton's campaign in 2016. He formed, along with Tony Podesta, the Podesta Group, right? John Podesta is no longer with it, but it's his brother. They and Greg Craig and this law firm were doing the same work that Paul Manafort was doing for Ukraine. Does that mean that they too are somehow a conveyor belt for Russian influence, this time in the Democratic Party?
Yeah, this is just standard operating procedure for politicians. I mean, this is how you cash in, right? You know, you have a high level public service job. And then, you know, you go out and you become a lobbyist and you make tons of money. And it doesn't really matter who you're hired for, you know, because you're a lobbyist. That's your job. Paul Manafort does it. Tony Podesta does it. You know, this guy, Greg Craig, does it. You know, they all do it. And some people like Paul Manafort don't want to pay their taxes on it. Like, it has nothing to do with, you know, a Russian plot to undermine American democracy. I mean, it's just sort of like how politics work. It's like the quid pro quo because, you know that, well, I could make like five times as much money as I am right now if you're a government official in the private sector. You know, it's the quid pro quo. It's like you're allowed to cash in afterwards and everybody does it. And Yanukovych, too, by the way, was not, I mean, he wasn't like a puppet of the Russian government. I mean, he was, you know, somebody who was trying to sort of chart a middle course.
Just to jump in there and you'll continue. The language of the New York Times is disingenuous. It says, Viktor Yanukovych, Russian-aligned Ukrainian government. What does Russian-aligned mean?
Right. Okay. So first of all, I mean, Yanukovych, whatever your opinions are of him, and, you know, certainly there are credible allegations that he's corrupt or whatever. I mean, he was elected. I mean, there were, like, democratic elections. It's not like, you know, the Russia invaded and installed him as the leader. And also, I mean, you know, so just think about Ukraine. So Ukraine is, you know, it's border, its main trading partner, especially for essential things like gas, is Russia, but Ukraine also does a ton of business with the European Union because they have a lot more money in the European Union. So isn't it sort of like natural for any Ukrainian leader like Yanukovych was doing to try to toe the line between those two things and not those two blocks and not try to upset one or favor the other over, you know, just to sort of inflame that? Like, you know, it's very normal behavior for a country like Ukraine to try to be on good terms with everybody.
Yeah. And again, if you're Putin and you're worried that Ukraine, which was the second biggest republic in the Soviet Union after Russia, the biggest republic in the Soviet Union and the western flank of Russia, you're concerned if the U.S. and NATO are moving constantly east, if they've gobbled up all of the other former Soviet republics in that area or the aligned states, the Eastern and Central European socialist governments, you're going to be worried that Ukraine could be incorporated into NATO, right? That's right on your borders. Okay. On the other hand, Yanukovych and whoever was the Ukrainian government before was playing they were dancing between the two blocks, between Russia and the West. Yanukovych was not anti-West. He said no to a particular European Association agreement / ultimatum in the fall of 2013 that set off the Maidan protests because the deal was an austerity deal. It was like what Germany and the EU offered Greece. Like, we're going to grind you down. And Yanukovych said no to that. He wanted a better deal. And so the American media says, see, he's a Kremlin-aligned pro-Putin guy. But guess what? Russia would have thought about Manafort's work or Tony Podesta's work in Ukraine or Greg Craig's work in Ukraine or his law firm's work in Ukraine as something dangerous because it would be these important, powerful Washington-based lobbyists trying to pull Yanukovych towards the West, not towards Russia. Again, this is a mischaracterization, but nonetheless, this law firm led by, and the headline should have been Obama's White House General Counsel, not a law firm.
Right.
They now have pled, well, what they've done is they've paid a $4.6 million fine to the Justice Department because they weren't honest about the fact that they were, in fact, representing the interests of Viktor Yanukovych in their lobbying efforts here in Washington. Jackie Lookman, time goes fast. We only have about 2.5 minutes left. I'm looking at another story. It's from the New York Times. It's an opinion piece by Lara Bazalone, The headline is Kamala Harris was not a progressive prosecutor. Progressive prosecutor is in quotes. The senator, this is the subtitle, was often on the wrong side of history when she served as California's attorney general. That might be a surprise to people right now.
Well, it's not a surprise to those of us who have been paying attention to the actual policies of potential contenders for this upcoming presidential election. Apparently, this term, quote unquote, progressive prosecutor, I think that the Democrats think that they can stick the word progressive in front of what anybody does, and they're going to convince us, hey, this is a good person for you to vote for. But we've been complaining about Kamala Harris for a while, largely last year and in 2016 because of Steve Mnuchin, because we have him in the first place, because she, when she was, I think, Attorney General of California, refused to prosecute him as the head of the largest and most corrupt financial institution that caused so much destruction in the mortgage industry with subprime loans and discriminatory behavior in California. But she also has some really problematic and just downright destructive policies in her time as a prosecutor, where she criminalized truancy for parents. She locked parents up when their children were truant from school. She was an advocate for the death penalty, putting forth this bizarre argument that the death penalty provides protections for American citizens that people enjoy and would somehow be harmed if the death penalty were eliminated in California. She was a proponent of mass incarceration. She was a proponent of for-profit prisons. Kamala Harris, there is a Twitter handle of someone that says Kamala Harris is a cop. And basically, that is the absolute truth. She was not a progressive prosecutor. She wasn't a friend of the people. She did a lot of damage as AG and as a prosecutor in California. She is not a friend of people of color. Her policies, a lot of her rulings harmed entire communities. And she's not a favorite among people of color in California. So this rebranding of her as a progressive prosecutor, it's not going to wash.
All right. Very, very important story. Anyway, that was the voice of Jacqueline Lookman. She is the editor-in-chief of Lookman Nation. You can check out their live stream every week on Facebook and YouTube. We were also joined in studio by Sputnik News analyst and producer Walter Smolarek. Stay with us.
Loud and clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR, CommunityPublicRadio.org. I'm your host, Don DeBar.